cases such as Eleanor's, other people who are abused by people who are put in positions of authority by institutions or organizations, be that the Boy Scouts of America or a particular church or the state of Oregon, a school district, whoever it is that puts that person in the power, in the position of authority, their sexual abuse conduct is outside the scope of the job description. No one hires them to sexually abuse children. And case law is very clear that those people are not going to be liable on that basis. The case law, however, is also supportive of a cause of action based on negligent supervision by an institution of its employees, negligence in hiring, in looking at the record of an individual. If, for instance, a pastor is diagnosed as a pedophile or as having problems with sexually abusive behavior somewhere in his education or training, or is put into a position in a church and a problem arises, report is made to the church authorities, the church authorities take action, and if the action is inappropriate and results in this pastor being put in another church where he can go ahead and sexually abuse more victims, then we believe that the liability of the institution for making those kinds of decisions should be something we can pursue. And the language in this case, we arguably would cover that kind of a case, although it's only arguably. It is not crystal clear on the face of this language. And we'd rather have half a loaf than none. We'd rather that this statute passed as it is written than have no statute passed. But if we could have a whole loaf, we would choose to have language which would make an action based on child abuse, but not only based on the actual act of child abuse, but on conduct which allows or permits or encourages child abuse. Now, that's a broadening of this, of the language that you see before you, but I think that it's fairly within the scope of this provision and really better addresses the concerns you've heard raised today, the concerns that the person who is actually responsible or the institution that is actually responsible for causing the harm end up paying for the harm. Because what you've got today are victims who have told you that the state is now paying for their counseling. And the state is now paying, in the case of Eleanor, to support her and her children, because the problems she has had have resulted in her not having the ability to support herself. And the problems of the actual perpetrator are that he's in prison and he hasn't got any money and he's not going to be able to pay for this treatment either. So I think it's a fairness principle, and in this situation it is fair to look to the institution to look for liability.
Thank you, Jack.
I guess I'm confused. Are you saying that this the extension of the statute of limitations only applies to the perpetrator, or it applies to the situations you're talking about as
I'm
well?
I'm saying that it should apply to the
I'm
situations
asking, no,
I'm talking about.
You how it's written now.
The way it is written down now, I believe that you can read the very first line of section 2 says, an action based on child abuse, and goes on. Well, an action for negligent supervision of, say, a pastor in a church is an action based on child abuse, arguably. It's not crystal clear that this statute refers to that kind of conduct.
Does the legislative history in the House committee shed any light on that?
The legislative history in the House does not. The issue was not raised specifically, and no one spoke against it. So the issue was just simply not raised. And I was not present in the House hearing on this, but the representative Judy Snyder of OTLA informed me that it was not raised. It was just simply not raised as an issue. And there was some hesitation to raise it if it was going to scuttle this legislation. If the fact that this was going to be broader than just covering the individual perpetrator was going to scuttle this legislation, OTLA didn't want to raise it, and I don't want to raise it if it's going to scuttle this bill. But I don't think this bill really goes far enough to accomplish the justifiable purposes that it's supposed to be covering. And adding that simple language after child abuse, an action based on child abuse or conduct allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse, I think believe that would solve any problem with that language.
If you have suggestions, I think you ought to get them drafted up and get them to Jack. And we also have the benefit of Catherine here, who's working on those issues as well. So we'll
I know we don't have the benefit of colloquy from the other members of this committee, but do you feel that the injection of additional language
well,
like that is going
to
cause a problem?
Well, let me say this to you. I think that I'm not interested in jeopardizing the bill either. I do think there will be committee members who have questions. I do think it's worth, if you have a concern you want it raised, the committee can either bring it forward, but we can't deal with it at all in a work session unless we have something in writing and we can get people back to explain their proposed amendments. But I suggest to you that you work with Judy Snyder and work with people who are also sponsors of the bill and see what you all decide to do about this and then give us some alternatives at work session time. If you care to.
Thank you.
Just another quick question. I want to make this fast because it's primarily to satisfy my own curiosity. She testified that she wasn't aware of the abuse until she started getting some counseling, I think is what
That's
I understood.
Eleanor, yeah.
Have you ever argued successfully that you come within the exception that from the time the harm is discovered because
discovery
of
rule, essentially?
Yeah.
Yes, in fact, there's a case pending on this specific issue. And we do not have a decision, and there are no, in Oregon, there is no case law, appellate case law on that topic.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Let's have Martha King, April Benton, and Nancy Davidin.
I'm Murthy King, and I'm from Forest Grove, Oregon. Sexual abuse is a power issue. Most abusers take away your ability to tell until, like, after years that you are away from them, sometimes never. It affects people by suppressing the memory completely until a person is strong enough to stand up against the abuser and your own family. The current statute just is not long enough for a person to get strong enough to tell and to keep telling. Incest does not stop just because you're no longer a minor. If a woman is raped by a guy on the street, she can be angry and report it. A woman who is raped by a relative is told to forget it, to forgive him, and to quit making up things. A child who is raped by a parent has no one to tell. Even if they could. Family life goes on as usual, and the abuser is protected by most families. It's a fact that about a third of all abusers are ministers and priests. Abusers love positions of authority, and because nobody dares to speak against them. 20 years is not enough time to talk or to work through the fear, the pain, and to get angry enough to stand up for yourself. I would like to say that I would hope that the people who are going to make laws that govern the punishment or the processes of crimes like this, that they be informed. And I brought this book. I think it has a lot of good information in it. It's called The Courage to Heal. It's by Ellen Bass and Laura Davis. At this point, I believe that we live in an abuser-protected society, and that also makes it really hard to tell. The average number of incidents of touching per year is 200 per abuser. Many survivors don't tell. For years after the crime, the abusers are real good at making sure that you don't tell, or horrible things will happen to you. My brother sexually abused me when I was 3, and when I was 17, he was 9 years older than I. He always told me that if I told, we would get in trouble, and that it would be my fault that my parents had heart attacks. I had been conditioned to believe that I had caused this to happen to me. I had no one to tell. I hid my secret with food, religion, alcohol, and drugs. I told no one until I got sober 4 years ago, 9 years after I had been raped at 17. I had to sit with him at family dinners to play the family game. A year ago, I got enough help to tell my parents. They didn't have heart attacks. They blamed me. Since I have to stand up for myself to get well, I have lost my family. There is no way that I could have done this work any sooner. The first 3 years of my recovery, I was frequently suicidal and scared to death that he would find out that I had told someone. He's a physical therapist in a major hospital in Portland. I'm an unemployed housewife. Who do you think that the courts would believe? Would you want him to treat your children? If I told his hospital, I would get in trouble, and he would come off the martyred hero. He told me once, about 2 years ago, that he was sorry that this thing happened between us, but not to tell anybody else about it and to keep it just between ourselves. He said this as he was staring at my chest, and that was at age 28. Sexual abuse is a power issue, not a sexual issue. Abusers make sure that their victims won't tell. They tell the victim that they are responsible for this. Telling about it takes power, personal power. Sexual abuse takes away that from a person. It's like, with the way the statute is written now, it's like expecting an accident survivor from an auto collision to report the accident about 5 minutes after impact, or he'll have no case. If the statute is changed from the way it already is, it will not affect my case. But being able to be heard today is as close as I will ever come to being heard or validated by this state. Thank you for your time.
April.
My name is April Benton. I'm 42 years old. I entered therapy about 2 years ago because I was suffering physical problems, stress-related diseases, and from depression. I really didn't understand that my lifelong emotional and physical problems were a direct result of the sexual abuse that I had to endure as a child. My father began abusing me when I was 2.5 years old, and it didn't stop until I left home at 16. My family denies that anything happened to me. They've used coercion and rejection to keep me quiet. And currently, I really have no relationship with my family. I have completely cut myself off from them. Even after I left home for many years, I was afraid to tell anybody. Since my abuse began at such an early age, I feel like I never developed the sense of self that I needed to speak out and to get help. So I urge you to consider the circumstances which keep victims quiet. And I guess the last thing I'd like to say is, obviously for me, even 5 years wouldn't do any good. And I think there may be many other victims out there that are in my age group. And I feel like my husband pays for my therapy right now. We have a little bit of insurance that helps. But he pays for it. And I don't feel that's real fair. I think my father should pay for the cost of what he's done to me. But I have no recourse against him at this point. Thank you.
It's interesting having this back-to-back with a forfeiture bill and where our priorities are and how hard we work to get forfeiture for certain other matters.
My name is Nancy Davidian, and I am a psychotherapist, and I have been one for the last 13 years, have worked primarily in the area of sexual abuse. I have worked with women, children, adolescents, did some work early on with young offenders. I've worked with both males and females. I coordinate the sexual abuse program at Lutheran Family Service in the Washington County office at this point, and do co-therapy with Jean Shirkup, who you saw earlier. For groups and work with individuals, mostly adult women at this point, and some adolescent women, I'm sorry. I strongly support this bill for several reasons, but the ones that come to mind are that it begins to reflect the realities of the kind of reporting that we've seen in our work. You've heard over and over again that people are not capable, they cannot report, especially in cases of incest, before emancipation. We do have some sampling. We have children who are in therapy because they have reported, but usually some circumstance has happened in which the abuse has been found out, or there is some functioning person in the family that brings it to light. But generally, this is not the case, and I think you've heard over and over again that statistics are just the tip of the iceberg, and the reason is primarily because we have not, I don't think, legislatively supported victims as much as we've tried to look at what to do with offenders. I think that we've made some effort.
Can I stop you a minute? Yes. Did you all give the same kind of testimony in the House committee?
No.
We're having trouble getting out of some of those committee members who sent us this wonderful package of crime prevention, getting tough on crime, to get a very minor, our little 479 bill. I'm diverting because this is just a visitation, if you will, which requires police officers to go to the door. Yeah, for people who've been are under temporary restraining orders to go retrieve their belongings from the household, and we get the police officers or the law and order mentality over there is absolutely unwilling to allow to say that they're willing to go, and if there's any sense of violence, they want to be able to leave the scene, and that's part of their concerns. I mean, it is rather interesting to see what's happening. When you put what's come over in the context of what we have here today, and there's got to be a way for us to figure out a way to approach this differently next time, whether it's a forfeiture for civil actions in particular kinds of cases. It seems to me there really has to be a full-fledged attempt at trying to figure out a way to do this whole thing better. And to refocus where people care to address some of these issues. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Nancy, but I think that there are people in this room who can make a difference next time around in the legislative session, and they need to be thinking about it now. Or, you know, we might think about it here, but it's pretty late.
I also want to say that I think we've made some effort in the media and schools and so on. I know there are programs, I have young children, to educate children about saying no and about reporting if sexual abuse, for instance, has occurred for them. And basically that doesn't always happen for the message is given to them. It doesn't always happen until emancipation. And then they come, and I've had teenagers come to me, and they were past the statute, late teenagers, past the statute of limitations before. And so we say to them, express yourself, tell if this has happened, speak out, say no, say this has happened to you, and then we say our hands are tied, and there's basically nothing we can do. And a person who has left their home, as April was talking about, at a very young age, is not financially able to support the kind of counseling that's required. And I think that one of the things that women have said to me over and over again is that I feel like I'm being re-victimized, or that the victimization is sort of like the gift that keeps on giving. When a person victimizes you, and then you have to continue to pay for that, their crime, for almost, in some cases, the rest of your life. I have had women come and report abuse to me for the first time. In the last 5 years, there were two women who were 65 years old, and this was the first time they were able to talk about it. So when we're talking about this statute, we're talking about really the beginning stages of looking at, you know, a more open-ended one would be one that would maybe really meet more of the needs, but this is a great place to start. I also wanted to say something about, I think that it's hard or difficult for people to believe sometimes that people could not know that they were sexually abused. And the fact is that over and over again we see that, and that there is this rather simplistic psychological idea that there are three choices that you have in a really stressful situation, and that is to live, die, or go crazy. And the sexual abuse survivor chooses to live. And the way they have to do that, especially in cases of incest, is that they have to use some form of defense mechanism, some blocking, splitting off, or denial of some form in order to survive that situation, or they absolutely could not go on. They would become suicidal, as you've heard today, or they would be crazy in one way or another, or use drugs and alcohol and so on. These defenses then become a lifeline for them. And the giving up of the defenses in order to come forth and say, this has happened to me, or I'm going to allow this into my awareness, is an extremely difficult process, and it involves learning to trust another person, say a therapist. And very often this doesn't happen until after about 1-2 years sometimes of therapy. And as Jean mentioned, people come in for other reasons and then begin to be aware that they can trust enough to let down that defense which has saved their life basically and see what has happened to them. So it's not realistic to assume that can happen with children. Even children that we work with, we don't know, the jury's still out really, on how much of an effect we can have if we don't continue to see people to later ages. Because as they begin to have their own children and make choices for partners and so on in their life, we watch patterns repeat themselves over and over again without this kind of help. And I guess the other thing that sort of came to mind, and I hope this isn't too much of an aside, but last week we had the Today Show or whatever in the Portland area, and I heard on the news many times about how Portland was the third highest crime city and so on in the United States, and I thought that it might be nice to bring up here. When I heard about this statute, I thought, we used to think of Oregon, or I thought of Oregon, I'm from Chicago, Illinois, as a state that was on the growing edge of legislation that was really helpful to people. And I think that this legislation, I'm having a hard time with my braces speaking, is on the growing edge of looking at extending the statutes in a way that's much more realistic for victims of abuse.
Thank you. There must be a way to forfeit.
Right. What kind?
Well, larger than the largesse of whatever is left. And we really need to start looking at some ways to get a hold of those issues before. And to tend to make people understand when it's easier not to see them in comparable terms somehow, and to look at who's mission we are here to serve in some ways. Thank you. I think we'll figure out a way. Well, it's thought-provoking, and I appreciate your coming. Thank you. We'll carry over 2518. Gary Wilhelms, I've had a conversation in the hall, and they're working on amendments on that, Gary, and we'll carry over the rest of the bills for... Do we have it? Well, I guess you'll have to watch the notices that are posted. We're going to try to squeeze in the bills we didn't get to today at another time, and those who've been posted will be heard first as we move things through the agenda. So thank you very much for coming. We're adjourned.